Some of you have probably read Dr. Meyer's works with maybe without even knowing it. His textbooks on psychology are used all over the place. One of the most popular textbooks for intro to psych courses at the university level. Anyone? Yeah. It's not that exactly. You've perhaps read others of his works. He is a professor of, thank you very much, psychology at Hope College, which is in Holland, Michigan, which is one of the centers of evangelicalism in the country, I'd have to say. Now, as I understand it, Hope is a little bit further to the west than Calvin.
Yes, if you're facing north, it's a little to the left.
A little to the left. And I was thinking this morning, that's kind of an interesting rivalry, Hope versus Calvin.
Oh, it's an enormous rivalry.
A little theological.
It has been said that if you live in West Michigan, and the definition of an atheist is to live in West Michigan and not care who wins the Hope-Calvin basketball game.
And that's saying something, because I think Hope has a brand new basketball stadium as well.
Absolutely. How do you know that?
I do my research.
Oh, my goodness. And sets the record for small college basketball attendance. It's very big.
And Hope actually is NCAA Division III, which my alma mater was as well. I know we've played the other side.
Correct. And the women's team won the national championship last year.
Fantastic. Now, I think one of the first times that I heard Dr. Meyer's name was in connection with the article, Accepting What Cannot Be Changed, which I think was about 2001, mm-hmm. that came out in the Reformed Perspectives Journal. And our friend Lou Smeads had written an article just shortly, maybe the same month or the month before that, in the journal.
Absolutely,
about
right.
Like the Whiteness of the Sea, and he was a keynoter here with us shortly after that, I think
right.
it was. And then your article appeared, and right. that was extremely influential, I think.
Yes, it's posted on the web, and it's just had thousands of visitors to the site, and that was part of what gave me the idea of maybe expanding that into a short book that would address some of the same issues. And by the way, Lou Smeads became for me a great encourager in that he took the position he did and so forth, helped encourage me to think it was okay to do the same.
Well, it was around that, yeah. It was around that time that I was writing a letter to the editor of my student newsletter, and I was writing some, you might guess, gay activist kind of article about evangelicals and how a lot of evangelicals are changing their mind on the issue of same-sex marriage and committed relationships. And I mentioned a number of evangelical scholars' names, including Lou's name and your name. And as I was thinking about that name of five or six people, I think almost all of them were from the Reformed tradition.
That's interesting. The Reformed tradition has as its motto, in fact, it's the motto of the Reformed Seminary that's across the street from Hope College, Reformed and ever reforming.
Hmm.
And I think that's a wonderful way of thinking. Last night, Ann Phillips talked about living the question. I mean, the spirit is still working, and we need to be continuing in the spirit of humility to learn and to grow, to be ever open, ever reforming our understandings. And that's the task of the church, and that's a process that I at least want to contribute to the conversation about.
And you're going to be bringing some of that this morning to us as well.
That's why I'm here.
Good. On this book about not just gay marriage, but marriage in general. And I was thinking it might be, though, kind of a problem if someone were to go into a Christian bookstore and ask for the book on Christian marriage, and they got the titles mixed up, and asked for Accepting What Cannot Be Changed.
Yes.
That'd be a different book about marriage altogether. But this one's very good, and you've co-authored it with Letha Scanzoni, who's also a friend of EC's.
Yes, indeed. She's been a speaker on a previous occasion, and Letha got there about 30 years ahead of me. And she has a mid-1970s book co-authored with Virginia Mollenkopf Is the Homosexual My Neighbor? To which the answer is yes, by the way.
It is. That's right. Many many copies of that book and of this book are available in the Resource Center for you, and Peter will help you with that. But I noticed that your title also ends with a question mark. What God has joined together?
That's interesting. We had a lot of conversation about the title of that book. My idea of the title was, what I want to be is a bridge builder, and so I wanted a somewhat less provocative title. Harper was very insistent on this title, and Letha was fine with it, so finally I conceded to the title, A Christian Case for Gay Marriage. Their argument being that the religious right is making the Christian case against gay marriage, and we need a forthright alternative. That's part of the conversation that we should be having. The new softcover edition is just out, that's I noticed up in the resources room, takes away the question mark.
Oh.
And the subtitle becomes, instead of A Christian Case for Gay Marriage, becomes The Christian Case for Gay Marriage, and that's what I put on the title slide.
Well, it's a very convincing case, too, actually. And you'd find Dr. Meyer's website extremely helpful as well, and I think it's... Is it David G. Meyer?
Yeah, I'll give it to you at the last slide.
It's there you go, get ready. It's an excellent website, and you're going to find information there about sexual orientation in general. Some of the best stuff that you're going to find on the net. It's very well-reasoned, well-documented, and I think our website has linked to it for quite a while. And it's very
helpful. And I linked to EC's website. So,
please welcome Dr. David Meyer.
What a unique and fun way to be introduced, to have a conversation with your introducer. Last night, Ann Phillips said that our seeming adversaries in the ex-gay movement are people we really have more in common with than we do differences. And I think that's a very good point. And when I go out and talk to church audiences, and my mission, by the way, is really to speak as a straight person of faith to my own community, I want to emphasize, first of all, when going into often a more conservative situation, our common ground is people of faith. We share a conviction that truth comes to us from the book of God's word and from the book of God's works. There's ongoing revelation. And we share certainly convictions that there's a biblical mandate for humility and openness. That ever-reforming spirit that we were just discussing is basic to faith, is basic to the enterprise of scholarship and learning, and it's certainly basic to our having conversation across our differences. And I think as people of faith, we also share a commitment to covenant sexuality. Sexuality is not mere recreational activity, it's something more humanly significant than that. And it's made to take place in the context of enduring relationship. Standing on that common ground then, what I want to do, and with Letha Scanzoni in this book, is to help bridge the divide between, on the one hand, traditionalists who wish to support and renew marriage about which they care so profoundly, and progressives who believe that sexual orientation is not a choice and that it is best lived out, whatever one's sexual orientation, within the context of a committed partnership. Well, the message that I derive from this and from what I'm going to present to you boils down to really just two sentences. One, sexual orientation is a natural, enduring disposition. And number two, the world would be a happier, healthier place on balance if for all people love, sex, and marriage went together. Now that's a pretty conservative position. It's only when I include the words for all people that it begins to become controversial. What is otherwise a conservative position? I come here to you this morning as a marriage supporter, and that's part of what I think maybe gives me the cachet to write this book, is nobody can fault my credentials as a supporter of marriage. I have written books about the significance of marriage for adult happiness and for the well-being of children. I've written about this in my textbooks. I've spoken on many campuses. I've contributed a large sum of money to marriage supporting organizations, most prominently the National Marriage Project, which I serve on the advisory board of, a centrist marriage supporting organization. And the evidence that drags me to this marriage supporting position, I'll just give you a quick glimpse at. There's a mountain of evidence to suggest that James Dobson and others are right, that marriage and permanent partnership is a contributor to human well-being. For example, Just look at the percentage of Americans who say they are very happy as a function of their marital status in the United States over the last three decades. Or consider, and on the basis of this, and other comments, I think George Bush was quite right to say a month and a half ago in a White House statement that marriage is the most enduring and important human institution. It's honored and encouraged in all cultures and by every religious faith. The co-parenting of children is a significant contributor to their well-being. And indeed, we have lots of data that that's the case. Here, for example, are data from more than 17,000 children studied in the National Child Health Survey, asking who had emotional or behavioral problems in the previous year for which they needed to be treated. And as you can see, the risk of such was markedly lower among those who were being co-parented in stable families than amongst those who were in alternative family structures. And you might say, well, this is just the result of the fact that these kids are more likely to live in poverty or some other factor. But in this study, the researchers held constant statistically parental income, parental race, parental education. All those things were held constant, and then family structure was allowed to vary. And you can see that children indeed benefit from being nurtured by two adults who are enduringly committed to each other and to the well-being of their children. Or let's look at who was repeated, who had to repeat a grade in school, or was been expelled or suspended, been the subject of a parent-teacher conference. Most kids are doing fine regardless of family structure, but as you can see, those children who are nurtured in stable parent families into which they were born are about at half the risk of all these maladies as those in alternative family structures. So, bottom line, marriage is indeed a social good, and the first two or three chapters of this book articulate the human need to belong, as social psychologists are calling it these days, and make the case for marriage, and talk about radical individualism and the media modeling of impulsive sexuality, as Hillary Clinton has called it, as toxic forces that are corroding the institution of marriage. Marriage is a social good because we know that children fare better in households with stable marriages. We know that adults are happier and also healthier and even wealthier than our non-married adults. Communities that have high marriage rates have less social pathology. You show me a neighborhood with a high rate of marriage, and I'll show you a neighborhood with a low rate of juvenile delinquency and educational dropout and poverty. And finally, we know that there are certain toxic forces that we can identify that are corroding marriage. Gay marriage is not one of them, but there are some real toxic forces that are at work and that we should be attending to. Now, with that background, that's not the talk you came here to hear, but that is part of my message. It's a marriage-supporting message. But my purpose, when I go out and talk on Christian college campuses, I'm going to be speaking at the University of Michigan and at Bowling Green and a number of churches and so forth in this next year, is first of all, not to pretend to represent gay and lesbian voices. You folks can tell your own stories. You don't need me for that. Secondly, it's not to pretend to offer any biblical expertise. And I leaned on Letha for the biblical chapters in our book. It is instead to shed light on sexual orientation. This is not a talk, I tell people, about homosexuality. It's a talk about sexual orientation, everybody's. You know, some people think, and they ask the question, what causes homosexuality? There's no research on that question. Just as there is no research on what causes left-handedness, there is research that compares left and right-handed people and discerns the differences between them. It's equally as much about right as left-handedness, and ditto for sexual orientation. So the evidence I'm about to give you some glimpses of is about everybody's sexual orientation. Yours, mine, Peggy Campolo's, you know, all of us. And so it's about all of us. Secondly, I want to reflect on heterosexuals' attitudes and the assumptions that we have that underlie those attitudes. And thirdly, I want to illustrate how family values, resolute support for marriage, can happily coexist with support for gay and lesbian aspirations. Well, there is a conflict. There's a culture war out there, to be sure. At the heart of the Methodist dispute, wrote the New York Times last fall, several clerics said, is a profound conflict over the nature of homosexuality. Is it something you can't control, or is it something sinful and that should be repented of? Well, says the past president of the Southern Baptist Convention, it's a sin to choose homosexuality as a lifestyle. It's not just a Christian point. One Islamic leader in the United States has said that homosexuality is a moral disorder. It's a moral disease, a sin, a corruption. No person is born homosexual, just like no one is born a thief, a liar, or a murderer. Pretty rough stuff, huh? So let's address the question, is sexual orientation a choice for anybody? Well, we can answer that question by triangulating. First, looking to our own experience. Do any of us recall choosing our sexual orientation? Or was it not for you, I invite people to reflect, something that at some point during your adolescent development, probably your early adolescent development, was just there? And by sexual orientation, I don't mean your behavior per se. I mean the direction of your fantasies and longings. And did it not just kind of appear unbidden, rather like website pop-up ads? On the screen of your consciousness. So it seems to be for most of us. And secondly, we can ask whether today's greater tolerance has influenced the population rate of sexual orientation. Oh, there's great concern that if we have gay folks in the media, as school teachers, as pastors or whatever, it's going to lead to an increasing rate of same-sex sexual orientation in the culture. But in fact, if we track the number of people who have changed their sexual orientation over time, we find it's essentially it's nil. For example, when the National Opinion Research Center a quarter century ago first asked American males about their sexuality, 97% reported that they had who were sexually active reported they had exclusively female partners in the preceding year. In the most recent occasion when they asked that question, it was still exactly 97%. So all the coming out, all the media, all the hullabaloo over this hasn't changed by one iota the population rate of sexual orientation. Just as we would expect, given the increasing evidence that there are biological influences on sexual orientation, which are what lead me to conclude. And I've been dragged to this conclusion, and believe me, it wasn't where I started, that sexual orientation, yours, mine, and everybody's, is a natural and enduring disposition. Ann Phillips last night talked about how she's changed. I've changed too. I mean, I used to think that sexual orientation was a moral choice. I used to think that the Bible resoundingly condemned homosexuality, not just having sprinkling of a very few verses dealing with ambiguous texts at that, dealing with same-sex behavior. I've come to understand that I was wrong about those things. Before I present this evidence, and we'll talk a little bit about the efforts to change sexual orientation, a couple of caveats. One, the data are clearest for men, and I say that not because I am a man, but because men display less of what today's psychological scientists call erotic plasticity than do women. Men's sexual desires, their intensity and direction and so forth, is more just absolutely consistent, persistent, and unvarying than is the case with female sexuality. Second, having said the things I'm about to say, these data cannot resolve the values question. Shall we regard sexual orientation as light-handedness? Most people are one way, a few folks are the other way. Who cares? I mean, it's morally neutral. Or as like alcoholism, which is also biologically influenced, but which, if we knew a way to stamp it out, we would do so because we consider it intrinsically not a healthy thing. Okay. Just a real quick review of some of this evidence that I'm sure you've been reading about because it's been much in the news even since we wrote this book. And by the way, all the evidence that's become available in the last year since this book came out has just reinforced the position that we've taken. First of all, the evidence points to some very interesting differences in the brains of gay and straight people. Best known of the available research studies came out about a decade ago from Simon LaVey when he found that a little neural cluster, what's called the interior hypothalamus, deep in the center of the brain, is reliably larger in straight men than it is in women and gay men. Well, that's very interesting, said people, but maybe that's a result of one's sexual behavior, because we do know that one's behavior leaves, and one's experience leaves fingerprints in the physiology of the brain. LaVey didn't think so, and we now have evidence that that indeed is probably not the case. Did you know that about 8% of male sheep, rams, display same-sex sexual orientation? They seek to mount other rams rather than seeking to mount ewes. They are the sheep breeders, by the way, called the duds, I'm told. It turns out that those homosexual rams, if you want to call them that, I think of them as that, display exactly the same brain difference in the interstitial nucleus of the anterior hypothalamus compared to straight rams, as we find in human beings. So there's evidence that it's not just true at the human level, it's true in at least one other mammalian species that's been well studied. Second, there are genetic influences on sexual orientation. We know from a very diverse set of studies that that if you have an identical twin, you're likely to share that identical twin sexual orientation, and more so than if you have, the concordance rate is higher than if you have a fraternal twin. Now, these data vary by study, but Michael Bailey at Northwestern University, for example, who has amassed all the data from the twin studies, says, bottom line, there's pretty clearly a genetic influence on sexual orientation, and it's more and more looking to be maternally transmitted. So if you're if you're a male, look to your mother's biological relatives to maybe find some clues to your own sexual orientation. And we now have evidence replicated recently that one can manipulate the sexual attraction displayed by male fruit flies by genetic manipulation. Third, there are studies that encompass prenatal hormonal influences. The second trimester of fetal development seems to be critical for the development of sexual orientation, and altered hormonal bath during that period can alter the sexual orientation, or at least the likelihood of sexual orientation, of the resulting offspring. And in sheep, this has actually been done experimentally. One of the sheep researchers associated with the federal government sheep research station has done this research and has told me that during the fetal development of sheep, hormone administration can alter the sexual orientation displays of the mature sheep that result. And what's happening prenatally also is pertinent to this study that maybe you've read about recently, it's been in the news again, and that is the oft-repeated finding. This is, unlike the twin studies, incredibly reliable. It's just amazing. Study after study after study finds that men with several older brothers are more likely to be gay. It's called the older brother effect now. It's a very reliable phenomenon. It's true in Canada and the United States. If you're a man in the United States and you have no older brothers, the chances are about 3% that you display and articulate same-sex sexual orientation. If you have one older brother, it increases about a third to about 4% or a little more. If you have two older brothers, about that much more, and so forth. If you have four older brothers, the chances are still 9 and 10 years straight, but we are up to 10% or so now. And people wondered, well, maybe this is a result somehow of sibling relationships or dynamics within the family, but you may have seen there was just a study just recently published found this is only true pertinent to biological older brothers. If you have adoptive older brothers, there's no older brother effect. So the phenomenon appears to be a biological phenomenon. And these brain differences, genetic differences, and prenatal hormonal influences on sexual orientation, and again, everyone's sexual orientation, seemingly contribute to a host of other gay-straight differences that have now been identified. And the nature of the fingerprint system, the organization of the hearing system, rates of left-handedness, occupational preferences, the relative length of the second and fourth digits, the list goes on and on and on. Let me just give you one example that's been off-studied and well-replicated, and that is spatial ability. One example of spatial ability is ability of what's called mental rotation. Which of these figures is identical to the target figure above it? this is one of the few human abilities that displays a reliable gender difference. Women are a little better at some things, men are a little better at other things. On average, the two sexes score the same on intelligence tests. And so, for example, in the study done in the United Kingdom, 60 straight men were about a half standard deviation above average in their ability to solve these problems, while 60 straight women who were studied are about a half standard deviation below average. Now, they also looked at and gave these tests to 60 gay men and 60 lesbian women. And as you can see, here, as in so many of these other behavioral variables, their performance is intermediate between those of straight men and straight women. And this is just one of a set of interesting findings that cohere so very nicely with the biological evidence. Who would have guessed this? Who would have chosen this? This is not a moral choice we're dealing with. This is a natural disposition. And so the emerging scientific picture seems to be that our brain is predisposed by our genes, it's shaped by prenatal hormones, and it's both influenced by and it influences our resulting experience. By the way, you're probably also aware that we have data now from some 450 animal species displaying same-sex behavior and sometimes enduring same-sex attractions, as has been the case with various pairs of penguins in various zoos in the world, such as until their recent breakup, Wendell and Cass at the New York Aquarium. But animal species that have displayed same-sex behavior cover a wide gamut, including grizzly bears, gorillas, flamingos, several species of salmon. Here are female bonobos, male African elephants. It gives you the idea, I think. I could show you lots of pictures. The bottom line, says Glenn Wilson and Kazi Rahman in a book published last fall entitled Aptly Born Gay, The Psychobiology of Sex Orientation, is that modern scientific research indicates that sexual orientation is largely determined by the time of birth, partly by genetics, more specifically by hormonal activity in the womb arising from various sources. That is the emerging scientific understanding. It's sort of like, I sort of feel like this, like some of the people who study global warming, who didn't used to believe that it was a real phenomenon, but there's so many different lines of evidence that all converge, all tell the same story. It's very hard to be an ever-reforming, open-minded, listening to the spirit person who would engage this evidence and not be persuaded that sexual orientation is a natural, enduring disposition. And the church, which is not assuming that, needs to take that lesson into account, whatever its views and understandings are going to be. Well, isn't it also the case that, like so many other things, there's a parental influence on sexual orientation? How we're reared, who reared you? Well, I put it this way to folks. If you were a young couple and you just had your first baby and you said, Dr. Myers, you've been studying this stuff for decades. You've read hundreds of studies of sexual orientation. Tell me, what can we do to influence the sexual orientation of our child? My honest answer is that I don't have a clue. I don't know a single thing you can do to influence the sexual orientation of your child.
Amen.
And if, I'm not saying there isn't any parental influence, but if there is, I don't know what it is, and it's yet to be discovered. And thus, a working conjecture can for the present be, I think, that the parental influence on sexual orientation is zero. And therefore, parents, if they don't like the sexual orientation of their children, whatever that may be, shouldn't be laying a great guilt trip on themselves, and shouldn't be placing a great burden on their children. Well, this is that there's evidence then, massive evidence, that there's biological influence on sexual orientation. What about the claim that people can change their sexual orientation? You're well familiar with so much of this evidence, but very briefly, here's how I tell the story. The claim got huge visibility back in 2001, as evidenced by this Focus on the Family website announcement that homosexuality has now been discovered to be preventable and treatable. Robert Gagnon, my antagonist on these matters, says that for any homosexual person, the hope exists for forming a heterosexual union. It brings some satisfaction of sexual urges. The American Family Association's web journal pronounced that psychiatrist now says homosexuals can change. Well, who is this psychiatrist and what did he say? This got national news. You read about it. You probably recall this. It was in the New York Times. It was on CBS News, Time Magazine. It was Robert Spitzer, the editor of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Psychiatric Disorders, the psychiatric Bible, if you will. He was working on it back in, what was it, 1953 or, no, 73 or whatever, when homosexuality was declassified as a psychiatric disorder. And he was criticized for that. And now he's saying that there are 200 people who changed their sexual orientation from homosexual to heterosexual. I had to write him, and I did. He was very gracious, and we had some correspondence, and he shared his slides with me that were the basis of these news reports. And so here are his slides, just a few of them. First of all, what did he do? Who are these 200 people? He went to ex-gay ministries, reparative therapists, and so forth across the nation. I've been hearing these stories. People have been urging me to look at them. Tell me who these people are. What are their names? What are their phone numbers? I want to call them. I want to talk to them. We're talking about millions of people, are we not, who have wished to change their sexual orientation or have sought to do so. How many have succeeded? Well, he found from all the ex-gay ministries and all the reparative therapists and et cetera, et cetera, 200 people that we're talking about an infinitesimal percentage of the population of people with the same sexual orientation who claim to have changed. And what were their retrospective reports? Well, interestingly, we find that only half of them said that they were exclusively homosexual before undergoing this change. And afterwards, among men, who were two-thirds of people with same-sex sexual orientation, only 17% are claiming to be exclusively heterosexual now. So first of all, their off-the-top claim was not of a 180-degree U-turn in their sexual orientation. What were they fantasizing about? Well, indeed, 9 in 10 were having same-sex fantasies before this supposed reorientation, and among men, still half were having same-sex fantasies predominantly. Or at least on 20% of occasions. Well, if you're still having same-sex fantasies, then I mean, you're like this. What can I say? And Ralph has told me stories of people, and perhaps some of you could vouch for such stories, of people who were among those called and who told reports that were not entirely authentic under the pressure of having to report a positive result. Ann Phillips last night was talking about how when she was involved in an ex-gay ministry, it was important that everything before had to be the worst of the worst. And after the change, you had to pretend to be someone whom you weren't. Were some of these people doing that? I think there's every reason to expect that that is the case. Consider the consistent result of research of this character that tries to gauge change based on people's testimonials of how some treatment program has affected them. We've done this with people in weight control, anti-smoking programs, academic support programs, juvenile delinquency prevention programs. In each case, after people have gone through a program, they will warmly testified, glowingly testified to the benefits. If I hadn't gone through this scared straight program or whatever, I'd be in prison today and so forth. However, those testimonials notwithstanding, if they will testify to substantial benefits, but if you randomly assign people to either participate in one of these programs to stop smoking or lose weight or not become, if you're an at-risk juvenile or whatever, and then compare those in the control and the experimental treatment groups at a later point in time, one routinely finds very little, if any, effect of that treatment, about which people have given glowing testimonials. And you know not to trust those glowing testimonials. That's why any new drug that's introduced by the FDA has to go through a clinical trial. It's not enough to have people take the drug and give testimonies. You don't trust what you read on obscure cable channels early in the morning, people testifying to their weight loss and so forth under this miracle program. You've got to compare. And when you do the comparison, you don't get the results. Well, why the testimonials then? How do they come about? It's because of a process we know as memory construction. The speed, magnitude, and certainty with which people revise their own histories is striking, said a couple of my colleagues, social psychologists. And indeed, memories are very malleable. We tend to invent a former self, and there's a great pressure to imagine ourselves as worse than we used to be in the past, and after we've invested a huge amount of time and money in a program, to, as Ann Phillips was saying, pretend to be somebody who's the person we want to be in the present, and thus those testimonials aren't persuasive. And even Robert Spitzer came to appreciate, by the way, I found Robert Spitzer well-meaning, but maybe a little bit, well, it wasn't completely aware, shall we say, of this social psychological research on how people revise their own recollections of their former selves. And he wrote in the Wall Street Journal, to my horror, some of the media reported this study as an attempt to show that homosexuality is a choice and substantial change is possible. In fact, I suspect the vast majority of gay people would be unable to alter by much a firmly established homosexual orientation. What we need, and what has never been done to my knowledge, Northwestern University researchers tell me they thought about doing this, and may do it at some point, is a simple experiment in which it'd be a clinical trial. And what we do is take volunteers who want to change their sexual orientation, measure their responsiveness to same versus other sex stimuli, and there are instruments for doing so. I won't give it on the detail, but it's to say, with men, it's rather like measuring Pinocchio's nose. Either an ex-gay ministry or a reparative therapy or whatever, or to a controlled condition, and then one, after a suitable length of time, and the therapy or the ex-gay ministry process has been completed, again measure their responsiveness to same versus other sex visually presented erotic stimuli. So, what do you think? If we did this, would the people in the treatment condition, but not those in the control condition, change their sexual responding? I think that all the indications, I know where I place my money on that bet, and I bet on the outcome of that experiment very confidently and comfortably, I think. But in the absence of the evidence, what we have are anecdotal stories, of which the most prominent one has been featured in so many news media, has been the case of John Paul, who, as many of you know, was discovered not long after this Newsweek's cover story in a gay bar in Washington, D.C. And now my point here is not about John Polk. I don't know John Polk, never met him, and I have no comment whatsoever to make about the authenticity of his personal story, and I really don't want to comment on that. What I found interesting was what his own organization, Exodus, which he served as chair of the board at the time, as well as the lead of Focus on the Family's ex-gay ministry program, what they said around that time. Bob Davies reported, their North American director of Exodus, said, all these so-called ex-gay stories sound the same. In virtually every case, men and women abandon their previously held view that homosexual behavior is a sin. Ultimately, they go with their feelings rather than admit to the authority of scriptures. I read that and I think, they go with their feelings, then they're not ex-gay, right? I mean, because it's your feelings that determine your sexual orientation. Davies said, after John Paul knowingly visited a gay bar, that I believe that as an organization, we also need to re-examine the public perception of our use of terms such as healing and change. Reading these articles is certainly heartbreaking, he said, but I find it interesting that the entire focus of each individual seemed to be changing their sexual orientation. That was very different from my focus upon entering Exodus many years ago. He said he came there for support in living out his Christian convictions that homosexual behavior was sinful. He wanted support in controlling his behavior. Well, okay, that's a, you know, a very different thing. And indeed, I think we see some convergence here between Ralph Blair and Bob Davies, for example. For Ralph wrote about that time that when repressed and in fine print, what reparative therapy and the ex-gay movement admit is that people are trying to control the expression of their sexual urges. And some who are helped to do so are coming from extremely sordid sexual lifestyles. There are a few claims of reorientation, but these are becoming fewer and fewer. And those that have claimed reorientation, as we saw last evening, keep changing their stories. Well, okay, it looks like sexual orientation is a natural and enduring enduring disposition, and thus one better accepted rather than continually fought with great frustration, guilt, and despair, and risk of suicide in some cases. But say people, what about the Bible? The Bible roundly condemns sexual orientation. Just a little fact, you've heard a lot about the Bible, so I don't need to go say much here, but little fact of the day, the Protestant canon of the Bible, did you know this, has 31,103 verses, of which some seven deal with same-sex behavior. And the other 96 deal with everything else that's in the Bible. And as Ralph Blair has and others have called to our attention, there's a nice brochure in the folder for the conference, most of these clobber passages involve some kind of proscribed behavior, such as adultery or promiscuity or the exploitation of children or temple idolatry or violent exploitation of somebody. And they, what they don't deal with, any of them, is loving, enduring partnership between two people of the same sex who are committed to one another. What do the Gospels have to say? What did Jesus have to say about, for example, the poor? Well, there's a long list of admonitions about the poor. What did Jesus have to say about homosexuality, homosexual behavior, and sexual orientation? That's it. Bono spoke to the presidential prayer breakfast, including President Bush, this last February, and he noted that the Bible has a little over 2,000 verses that deal with the poor, justice, and so forth. He said, that is a lot of airtime, folks. And it seems to me, as followers of Jesus, as biblical people, shouldn't we all, whatever our opinions, could we not agree on this, that we should try to keep on our radar screens the priorities, the concerns that Jesus and the other biblical writers had on theirs? To be a follower of Jesus. And so when people tell me, you know, this, you got to understand, this is a really important issue. This is a crisis issue for the church because it's all about holding true to the Bible. But the Bible has almost nothing that biblical scholars aren't arguing about to say about this topic. But it has a mountain of things to say that might be relevant to whether or not we should be eliminating estate taxes to enable the preservation of wealth while not raising the minimum wage above $5.15 an hour. It seems to me the Bible has so much to say about that and so little to say about this. Aren't we indeed being biblically unfaithful by allowing the gay marriage issue and the gay ordination issue to hijack the church's time and attention and priority? By the way, I did a little search of the RSV and found, and you can search electronic, I just had to confirm this. This is just a captured from the computer screen and dumped into this slide result. Search for homosexuality, entire Bible, no results. NIV, sorry, no results found for homosexuality. Of course, the concept is barely more than a century old as we've come to understand it. Lewis Smedes, whom Steve referred to earlier, wrote in his book Sex for Christians that homosexuality is a burden that homosexual people are called to bear and bear as morally as possible, even though they never chose to bear it, which was probably part of his message when he spoke here several years ago. 6 months before he died, accidental death, hanging Christmas lights, he sent me an email and said, if I could rewrite that book, I would add one more sentence after that, and that sentence would be this. It is a burden most obediently and creatively borne in a committed love partnership with another. And I guess in some sense what I'm trying to do, since Lou didn't get a chance to write that sentence, is to take that sentence and flesh it out. So our book is entitled The Christian Case for Gay Marriage, and the case for gay marriage is built along two lines. First of all, it acknowledges and builds upon what I earlier referred to as the deep human need to belong, to connect in close, supportive, caring, committed, enduring relationships. We are social animals. We thrive best not alone in the world, but connected to others in close relationship. That doesn't have to mean a marriage for everybody, but for many people it does. For other people, there are soulmates, there are kinship relationships that are significant in other ways too. But all human beings, it's a pan-human need, this need to belong. Secondly, it's a case that's built on justice, because there's a whole long list of rights in the Federal Register, more than 1,000 of them, that are associated with the institution of marriage and which are not available to people who are not allowed to marry. Civil union is sort of half a loaf. It gives you some of those rights, but not others of those rights. A list with which you're well familiar, I'm sure. Also, then, what we need to do is engage the 7 familiar arguments against gay marriage, saying, for example, that this is a contradiction that would change the ages-old definition of marriage. I'll show you how the definition of marriage has changed over time in a moment. Saying that, marriage, by definition, implies procreation, and that's not possible when people of the same sex marry each other. It was really kind of cute. One time, somebody was making that point to me after a talk, and the couple standing next to them that were the next persons waiting to talk to me were a pair of widowers who had recently remarried in their 70s. And I said, you want to make that argument to them? Obviously, that's not something that we think that people who are beyond, who are not sexually fertile should not have the right to marry, because marriage is more than procreation. The list goes on. Gay marriage will undermine traditional marriage. Really? What really threatens marriage? In an era when pornography has become bigger business than professional football, when cohabitation precedes most marriages now, I could give you a long list of things that really are threats to marriage. And we should, I would suggest, keep our eye on the ball. Jonathan Rauch, in his wonderful book, Making a Conservative Case for Gay Marriage, develops this argument that without gay marriage, we're supporting the alternatives to marriage movement that is taking down the institution of marriage. Because corporations, universities, and so forth, are feeling the need to, as a matter of equity, offer domestic partner benefits to gay couples. And then straight cohabiting couples want those too. And the net result is that marriage is eroded. The way to strengthen marriage is to raise the bar. Say to everybody, regardless of sexual orientation, if you want the benefits of marriage, marry. It's available to all. Allowing gay people to marry doesn't harm marriage. It doesn't reduce the pool of available marriage licenses. and if we have this single standard, and if we articulated it from the bully pulpit of the White House, a consistent pro-marriage standard, we would strengthen marriage as a result of passing gay marriage, not weaken it. We could say more. We can talk more about any one of those things, but I want to just make a couple points in conclusion here, and then give you time before 10:30 to say a few things back. I thought you might find it interesting to see how attitudes and assumptions are changing in the United States over the last couple of decades. I know you read things like the Washington Supreme Court and the New York State Supreme Court have both made decisions that narrowly denied same-sex marriage in their states within the last month, and you see more states passing constitutional bans against gay marriage, and you get kind of discouraged. I think there's reason to be encouraged. And let me just show you some of the data trends. Here's the percentage of people who say homosexuality is never justified. In 22 Western countries, all 22, the percentage who agree with that statement has gone down over the last couple of decades. In the United States, from 65 to 31%. What about allowing homosexuals equal rights in terms of employment? From 1977 to 2004, we can see that was from barely over half to 9 in 10 Americans agree. What about gays in the military, gays as elementary school teachers, gays as clergy? Over the last 30 years, we've seen dramatic increases in support for equal rights in each of those areas. Percentage of entering collegians, a quarter million of whom are assigned, sampled annually, and some 13 million of whom are represented in this figure, who agree that it's important to have laws prohibiting homosexual relationships, has plummeted, as you can see, from 53% in 1987 to about 1 in 4 this last year. Support for gay unions, as ascertained by the CBS New York Times poll, was at 42% against a year and a half or so ago, and 4 was actually up to more than 6 in 10, a little over half of whom preferred civil unions and a little less than half of whom preferred marriage. But the majority are approving of some sort of legal union of same-sex adults. Do you think marriages, if we take out the civil union option, do you think marriages between homosexuals should or should not be recognized by the law as valid? Gallup surveys reveal over the last 10 years that's gone from a little over 1 in 4 adults approving to almost 4 in 10. I was driving to the airport on the radio listening to NPR recently, and they were interviewing somebody from one of the national organizations that is opposing same-sex marriage and saying that it's very important that we get the federal marriage amendment passed sometime within the next several years, because if we don't, it's going to be lost, given the change in opinion over time. And they're right. If you're here opposing same-sex marriage and wanting state bans and a federal marriage amendment, you really need to work very hard very soon, or the opportunity is going to be beyond you. How many favor allowing gays and lesbians to marry legally? Again, the Pew surveys find exactly the same result. And I would suggest to you that these trends are likely to continue. First of all, because attitudes tend to follow social practice. And look at what's happened in the state of Massachusetts. Some 40% supported same-sex marriage before it became legal, and now, a year after it was legal, 56% were supporting. And thus, if Massachusetts does have a ballot initiative, as is being sought by some in another year, I think it's really a jump ball as to whether that will pass or fail. Secondly, there's a growing public understanding of sexual orientation. And people's understanding is changing. Do you, in your view, is homosexuality something a person's born with, or is it due to other factors such as upbringing or the environment? As you can see, in 1977, only 13% of Americans thought it was something that was born with. By 2006, that was over 40%, and in Canada and the United Kingdom, it's past 50%. So our understanding is changing. And among those who believe homosexual behavior is morally wrong, we see that as education increases, the likelihood of believing that decreases. So education is an antidote to anti-gay and lesbian attitudes. Third, gays are coming out. Many of you have. Your friends and family know you, and over time, that changes the attitudes. Mel Hoyt has said, it's not just what you know, it's who you know. And indeed, there's evidence that among those who knowingly know a gay, the chances of their expressing intolerant attitudes are much less than among those who don't knowingly know a gay. And finally, the generations are changing. And this is huge, because there's an enormous generation gap. For example, here's one sample survey. Do you favor or oppose a law allowing homosexuals to marry? Among those over 65, 14% favor such a law. Among those under 30, the majority favor such a law. Well, I don't know how to put this to the older folks, but generational succession is destiny. And my generation, and I'm in my 60s now, is not going to be here forever. And there's a new generation that will be replacing us. And if attitudes continue to change, if understanding continues to evolve, and as the generations succeed themselves, we can see where we're going. And we can see why the federal marriage supporters are right, that their job has to be done soon or it's going to be lost, because a different day is on the horizon. And so that's, I think, good news. I love these opinion polling data, but just a couple other points here. At the time of the national presidential election exit polling, 27% of Americans said they supported gay marriage, 35% supported civil unions, at 62%, that's about what we found in some of the other data that I showed you. Consider what a change. Wow, that's only 4 years out from Vermont. Howard Dean, remember? Civil unions, wow, how radical. I mean, how off the charts, you know, left end. That's now, 4 years later, what 6 in 10 Americans believe. And in fact, even President Bush, a year before the 2004 election, declared himself opposed to civil unions. The summer before the election, he said, yeah, I didn't know how he felt. He is still working that one through. The week before the election, when an ABC News interviewer asked, he said he was for civil unions. And the stunned interviewer said, but that contradicts the platform of your own party. He said, I know it does. I don't agree with the platform of my own party on this issue. Opinions are changing, and President Bush and the general public both illustrate that. So, what should the church be focusing on? Well, people of faith, first of all, let's recognize we've wrestled with issues of sexuality and marriage for a long time, and we've changed our minds often. We've changed our minds from Old Testament times, and still in some parts of the world today where polygamy was widely practiced, to thinking that marriage has to mean monogamy. We've changed from believing in arranged marriages to, in the West, thinking that marriages should be a matter of romantic choice. We've changed our definition of marriage from seeing marriage as a second-class state, better to marry than burn, to one that regards it as at least equal to the single life. We've changed our definition of marriage as one that involves male headship to one that involves a more mutuality and egalitarian relationship. We've changed our idea of marriage as one that has to be between people of the same race. Because, boy, if we allowed interracial marriage, it would violate scriptures, it would destroy the institution. All the same arguments were rehearsed a half century ago in a different context to accepting interracial marriage. There, I got that bugger. we've changed our definition of marriage from disciplining to welcoming divorced people. We just now in the midst of another modification of our definition of marriage, one that would admit another 3% or so of people to the altar. And is it that big a change compared to some of the previous change in the definitions of marriage, none of which have destroyed the institution of marriage, just as this one won't? What should the church be focusing on? Well, some things, when the church speaks, it makes a difference. Premarital sex is always wrong, say 13% of those who never go to church and 74% who attend more than weekly. On that subject, the church makes a difference. What about on sexual orientation? Here's the percentage of men who have had a same-sex partner in the, the percentage of men who have a same-sex partner among those who never attend church. That's like 3%. Okay, so that's about the national norm. 3% of men in the United States have had a same-sex partner in the last 2 months. Okay, what about, however, men who are faithful in going to church? They're there. They've been hearing the church's message about this. What percent of them have had a same-sex sexual partner in the last 2 months? Want to guess? Here it comes. 3.3%. They're basically the same. All the church is talking about on this issue, it's having no effect. on the sexual orientation of its own members. It has an effect on premarital sexuality, on non-marital sexuality. I mean, in some ways it has effect over things that over which we have voluntary control, but not our sexual orientation. So what should we do? I say, let's ask, what would Jesus do? Let's put on our radar screen what Jesus had on Jesus on his radar screen. And if we're going to risk error, and this is what finally gave me the courage to venture this effort, should it not be, if we're going to risk error, on the side of, should it be on the side of judgment and exclusion, or should we be risking error on the side of grace and inclusion? And shouldn't we, how about this for a national movement called Refocus on the Family? supporting marriage and co-parenting? Or is there somebody who could make the credible argument that in order to support marriage among homosexuals, we must, heterosexuals, we must keep homosexuals unmarried? And I have not, I keep waiting for that argument to be credibly advanced. There is a problem with the decline of marriage in the culture. The percentage of first children conceived in marriage has been declining and is now crossed under 50%. The percentage of births to unmarried parents in the United States, which was at about 5% for the first half of this century, has now zoomed to over 1 in 3. Everybody, whether they're on the left or the right, whether they're Planned Parenthood or Focus on the Family, agrees that's not good. That's not healthy for those kids or for the future of the country. That's true even in my own Holland Hospital, whose data you see is the green dots there. So why not focus on the family? Keep our focus on the pertinent issues for the strengthening of marriage, and that's fidelity, commitment, and marriage. That's what we should be doing. Screwtape, though, has a different a bit of advice. Senior Devil, speaking to the junior devil in C.S. Lewis's book, says, the game is to have them all running about with fire extinguishers whenever there's a flood. I submit to you, that's what the church is doing in the United States right now, the evangelical church especially. It's running about with a fire extinguisher when there's a flood that's overwhelming marriage. It's got its eye off the ball. And so it's because we're biblically faithful, it's because we support marriage, that I think we can comfortably support same-sex marriage. So, to conclude, and I'm done, I want to say, I venture everything, you know, tentatively, where it's that, you know, I may be wrong about some of what I've said, and that's why we need to have conversation and dialogue. But it looks to me more and more like sexual orientation is not a choice, and that telling people otherwise causes a great deal of pain, frustration, guilt, potential loss of faith among people who've been chased out of the church, some of whom you know, and some of whom it's probably been true of you at some time in your life. Secondly, all human beings have a need to belong. Third, the Bible assumes and supports male-female union, but it has little to say about sexual orientation as we understand it, as an enduring disposition, and as lived out in committed partnership between people who love one another. Fourth, family values, a priority on covenantal relationships, and a high view of Scripture can all comfortably and happily coexist with full and equal participation of gay and lesbian persons in the culture and in the life of the church. And finally, attitudes and assumptions are presently in a rapid state of transition. So, the story is being written, it's to be continued. Our little contribution to it is in this little book, which is just a little 125-page book. It's intended to be something somebody could read in an evening or use for an adult study. And if you're interested in contacting me, it's not my last slide. My last slide was going to be just my website to answer Steve's question is just my name, davidmyers.org. David Myers, M-Y-E-R-S.org. And if you want to reach me, you can through that. And I've created a page of resources that link not only to evangelicals' concern, but to things on the other side. I mean, just to a variety of places, but including evangelicals' concern. Thanks for allowing me to be your guest today. It's been great.